RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Welcome to this edition of RDI Insights, a rather different one today, as I am the victim and master of the RDI faculty, Tom Lloyd, is the interrogator. So I hesitantly hand you over to Tom in London, with me sitting here nervously at my home in Dorset.
My name is Tom Lloyd, and it is my great pleasure today to be interviewing Royal Designer for Industry, Mike Dempsey. In this case, the tables have been turned. Nearly 20 years ago, Mike started what is now known as the RDI Insights series of audio interviews with fellow Royal Designers for Industry. Mike will be the 60th interview of its type, but the first in which he, his life and work, is the subject of the discussion. Mike was born and raised in the industrial heartland of Dagenham to the east of London, leaving school at 15 to become a fitter's mate. The world of design was a remote and unlikely career path, but Mike had always been at home with drawing and making. This urge eventually led him to evening classes in what was then known as illuminated typography, and from there into the world of publishing. A graphic design career of over 50 years followed. After 10 years in the world of publishing, Mike founded his own design agency, which in 1979 was to become Carroll, Dempsey and Thirkell. He has created everything from stamps to film title sequences and editorial design to visual identities. Mike is a writer, photographer, broadcaster, painter, blogger, and studied acting at the Method Studio, London. He has won 10 DNAD Silvers and a Gold, elected a member of the Alliance Graphic International, was president of the DNAD, and past master of the Faculty of Royal Designers for Industry. Mike left CDT at the end of 2007 to form Studio Dempsey. Mike, it's a great pleasure to be here today, and I have to say, it's quite a privilege. You've been interviewing RDIs for 16 years as a part of your RDI Insight series, and today the tables have turned, and it's your turn to be interviewed. How does that feel?
I feel slightly out of control because, you know, obviously when one is interviewing, you've formulated in your head what you want to, where you want to get to. And so this is the first time this has happened. I mean, I have been interviewed in small things over the years, but nothing like this because I've had to, in a way, investigate myself. I usually try to do as much research as possible on people so that I know about them before I'm talking to them. So here I sort of feel slightly adrift at sea with one of those rubber tires.
Well, maybe that's a good thing in this case. So you've been, apart from your design and your creative career, as a communicator, you've long written and obviously through your Insights series spoken about design and communicated to the outside world through your blog and through your writing. That seems to be an important part of your process and your practice and your curiosity about life. Can you talk a bit about that?
The world of design, and I mean by that the wider world of designers, has increasingly interested me over the years. I'm very lucky to have been in the industry that I'm sort of still hanging in there in, because I absolutely love it and I find it fascinating. I find it interesting to know how people get to where they are and how they come up with their ideas. And I like the commonality. It's certainly doing these interviews, you realize how close we all are in character and thinking. And it's like, I remember when the RDIs had their summer schools, you would go with a whole group of RDIs and young designers in their first 5 years. And it would be like going to another planet where everybody was on the same page. You had this shorthand. And that's what I love about being in the creative field. You are with people that you understand. You don't have that awful going to a party where nobody's a designer and they say, well, what do you do? And you say, well, I'm a graphic designer. And immediately it becomes really difficult because even my mother didn't know what I did, really.
Yes, it's funny how I call myself a furniture designer when I'm communicating to a kind of layperson, because I think it's the easiest bit of shorthand. Everyone can imagine a chair. But if I actually tell them what I did from day to day, it would be much harder to communicate that sort of reality, that truth.
Exactly.
You know, we are both Royal Designers. You've been a Royal Designer for Industry since mid-90s, and you became Master in, was it 2005? Obviously, the Faculty of Royal Designers is a very broad church, and maybe that's a great example of what you're talking about, which is this common thread across so many disparate and different
practices of design and decorative arts in a way, which I suppose we also capture.
When I first walked into the first meeting, there were people there like Abraham Gaines and Enid Marx sitting at the table, and John Box, the great film designer. And I was completely in awe. I mean, there was Abraham Gaines smoking his pipe in a tweed suit. And I just sat on the edges like a child, really, just listening. And I thought, wow, this is incredible being with these people. It opened up my mind a lot to the expanse of the world of design and also the incredible intelligence of these people. Coming from the background that I came from, I was completely humbled.
Yes, and we'll come on to your background in a few minutes, because clearly you had a particular, perhaps unorthodox, entry into the design profession, which we'd love to hear about. It's also interesting sitting in the faculty for, you know, for me, it's, I think, nearly 15 years. It is an awe-inspiring thing, but also you see the change of what design does and is over that time, don't you? The perception of where, how you define design and how it can contribute to the world.
And certainly in my time, since, you know, that sounds very old-fashioned in my time, but anyway, since I've been involved, the acceleration of what design actually is has changed enormously. And a lot of people find it difficult to embrace new areas, and to a certain extent I have and still have, but I've also tried to trailblaze, if you like. You know, I got sound design in, which was really difficult because no one... I remember dear old Alan Fletcher saying at a meeting, well, you can't see it. And I said, Alan, are you telling me that sound, you can't see sound? So it was a struggle. I got it through the third time anyway, and I was pleased about that. And likewise, the first digital RDI, who was Malcolm Garrett, that was my doing, because, you know, I felt, wow, we're now in the digital age and there's no one that's representing that area. So I do recognize change, and I've seen a lot of change. Sometimes it's tough. You're confronted by things that you really don't get, and I think that's down to others to persuade you otherwise. That's the beauty of being part of the faculty.
Yes, and it's interesting that the canvas on which you consume design has changes. So from a sort of what we might call an analog or a print-based surface to a digital interface, maybe the sense of communication is the same, but obviously the practice and the output can be completely different.
And the understanding of what it actually is, how it's actually done. I mean, I think service design was a great example of that, where service design cropped up many times and so few people seem to understand how it worked. And, you know, now it's easy to understand. You know that there's this, it's almost like the underground of design. It's what you don't see that is incredible, what it can do. You know, getting you from A to B seamlessly is a design process. Now we have experts in that field with us. So design is an ever-changing beast.
And actually, on the service design topic, I think Ben Terrett, who became an RDI in the last few years, I think the example of gov.uk was such a brilliant one, because we all buy our car tax on it, and we all, you know, have to make inquiries on it and pay our tax, and it suddenly became a very transparent and clear representation of what good design or what good service design can deliver to us all on a daily basis. And I think that was a very kind of visceral experience of saying, yes, that is, it was still a typography project, even though it was a very restricted and sort of pared down system. But I thought that was an interesting sort of epiphany for everyone, that helped to break that barrier of what service design is.
Well, I think the typographical aspect is great because it is so pared down. And if you remember government websites before that, they were complete chaos. Everyone was different. So, you know, harnessing them, bringing them into one style was one part of it. But actually, it's what goes on under the bonnet, really, how you can get from A to B very quickly, how it can serve you and give you information absolutely fast. That's the beauty of service design, not the typography, which is simple and stripped back. And I just hope the government, as they're ever changing, don't screw that up, because, you know, it is a marvellous thing, one of the best things the government has ever embracing at that important area.
And it was interesting that in that case, I think Ben and his team, they created effectively an agency within the civil service to deliver that piece of work. And I think that sense of independence was also an important part of allowing them to act as an agency, delivering a service to a client, and not being too pulled by the various pressures within government.
Well, I think also the beauty of that is that by having this internal group, little internal design company, if you like, within the government, they work collaboratively and tested everything over and over again until it worked. And that's great. And I think they're dealing with something, you know, service design, that very few people outside of that little group of people within government would understand. They think everything's paper driven and you just type out an email and it's all done. They don't understand the complexity of it. Complex, but looking very simple. That's what the beauty of it is.
And clearly, even especially with this current government, the idea that you want to have value for money or that you can make efficiencies, clearly that service is probably the most efficient service, because if it reduces the number of failures or the number of processes that you need to go through to achieve a result, then that's in a way what good public service should be about.
Absolutely. I agree. Yeah.
And I think the other thing on that before we move on is that I think they had a very good client, Francis Maud, who I think was in the Cabinet Office at the time. Just like all projects, you need a good client. You need a client who understands you and who you can challenge, but who's happy to be a part of that process, part of that journey.
I agree totally. I think a champion of your work, i.e. the client, you really need to find clients that really want to understand what design can do and support you. And there are so many jobs, I'm sure you've had them, I've had them, where you're often dealing with one person, but actually they're having to take their lead from other people that you never get to meet. Certainly in the world of graphic design that happens, and it's frustrating. And I've always made a point of trying to seek out the very people that make the decisions so that you can have a really good one-to-one conversation. And when you do, and if they get it, the jobs that you produce are so much better and rewarding all round. So I think clients are really important with the right attitude.
So maybe we should just come back to you. And as we touched on at the beginning, you had an unconventional or unorthodox sort of start in life as a designer and enter the profession of design. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that and just, you know, how you got from schooling, if you like, into the design profession.
My earliest memory was around probably 5 when I started infant school. I remember on the first day, I couldn't understand why all the kids around me were crying seeing their mothers leaving. I was excited by this new world. My dad, he came over from Ireland in the 1930s because there was no employment in Ireland. Many thousands of Irish men, mostly, came over to the UK for work, as he did, and was confronted with a very welcoming sign on many of the properties that you're trying to find a place to live, which he called digs rather than a flat, that would say no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. And, you know, it was tough. And he met my mother, who's from the East End of London. And we lived in a small council house in Dagenham in Essex. And we were pretty poor. Everything was secondhand. Furniture, the clothes. There was no hot water or central heating. Just a small open coal fire. And an extremely dangerous oil heater. There was no fridge or washing machine or books, telephone or TV, just an old Bakelite radio that I used to huddle around to listen to The Goon Show and Journey into Space, which is one of my favourite programmes. It's funny, there's been a lot of talk lately about warm hubs, you know, where people can go to keep them warm when they can't afford to heat their homes. That rang a bell in me because on cold winter's days in the 1950s, I would go to the local library where I would sit by a cosy, warm radiator, and I became interested in books to look at rather than read. So that was my kind of backdrop in the 1950s. And I didn't mean to turn it into a sob story, because it's exactly the same for all the people around us. So I wasn't really conscious of our financial circumstances at all. I was pretty hopeless at school, as I found it very difficult to read. But I loved drawing, and my mum would buy me those rolls of liner paper from the decorating shop because it was very cheap. And I would roll it out on our little kitchen table and draw huge rocket ships and divide them into different levels, you know, sleeping and eating quarters, a gym, a radio receiving area and a control room. And I would do this sort of thing every night. And I loved it. It was a kind of escape into my own fantasy world. I didn't really read until I was about 11 because I had real trouble. I had, you know, what would now be called dyslexia, and I've always suffered with that. And so, you know, my school years, I hated them. I then moved on to secondary modern, as they were called, secondary modern school in the 50s, one of the, you know, the government's initiatives, brand new school, but teachers that really didn't care that much because they knew that everyone would end up in the factories. But I spent most of my time in the art room. Nobody else did, actually. Most of the kids were busy in the metalwork room making rings with spikes in them because there were lots of gangs, and it was really quite frightening. And a lot of those gang members were at the school and would beat people up. Because I could draw, I became the tattoo artist because I have one of those pens, you know, that had three colours, biro, and I could draw little tattoos, which would be daggers with snakes entwined, you know, and they thought that was great. So I was kind of protected. I was told I wasn't bright enough to sit the 11 plus. But actually, at the age of 14, I did take one O-level in art, and I got that. And my mum proudly pinned the certificate up in our front room. More often than not, on Saturdays, I would go with my mum to the matinee performance at our local cinema, where we'd sit in the dark and be transported to Hollywood. And that led, for me, a lifelong love of cinema. And I bless my mum for that, and all those rolls of liner paper and pencils. Before leaving school, they had this thing called a meeting with the youth employment officer. So, you know, you go into school with a tie on and a, you know, mother sort of wiping you around the mouth with her handkerchief to make sure you haven't got any breakfast. And she came along with me, and we sat in this room. And the youth employment officer said to me, "Well, Michael, what sort of thing would you like to consider doing?" And I said, by this time I was obsessed with Walt Disney. He was my hero, and I wanted to be a cell animation artist. I'd read about this, and I knew nothing about it. My parents couldn't help in any way because they didn't understand that world. And I said I'd like to work as a cell animation artist for Walt Disney. And he said to me, "Oh, well, I mean." Well, I mean, that involves, college and university and that sort of thing. But I tell you what, Michael, this is what I think you should do. You should get a good trade behind you. And as it happens, I've got this very good job here, which you go to an interview tomorrow. And, you know, if they like you, you could start. And that job was a fitter's mate in Aldersgate Street, London, which is now, it's now where the Museum of London is. It's called Barbican. That was a bomb site. And I ended up working in this dreadful place, which I hated. And that was the beginning of a succession of really, really awful jobs. I first worked as a fitter's mate, then in a TV factory on the assembly line, onto a messenger at the London stockbroker. Then my last job in that soul-destroying world was in a shirt factory warehouse. I hated them all. Until one evening, I decided, I've got to do something. There comes a point in your life when you actually think, I'm going to be here for the rest of my life. And I don't know what it was, but with me, I had this inner strength. And so I got on my bike and I went to the local tech, which had evening classes, to see whether I could do anything that was creative. And I got there a month too late. And they said, "Oh, no, all the classes have gone in painting and all the rest of it." And they said, "But there's one here. There's calligraphy and illuminating lettering." And I didn't know what that was, but I said, "No, I'll do that. And I went and I absolutely loved it. Immediately I realized handwriting was could be such a beautiful thing. So I changed my handwriting. You know, it took a long time. I was involved in letter forms and illuminated lettering, which is a very ancient thing. You know, all these monks used to do it. And then I used to meet people in the break. And I met this young guy who worked in a commercial art studio. And I said to him, "If ever there are any jobs going, I'd really like to get into that world." And he said, "Well, if anything happens, I'll tell you." I then discovered in the break the reference library. And in the reference library, I would go through lots of books that I'd never seen before. They were books about industrial design and one that was about graphics, and it was called The Graphic Artist and His Design Problems by Joseph Müller-Brockmann, who is a Swiss designer. And this book, it was brand new then. And when I opened it and I looked through this book, I suddenly realized that this was a job. This was a job about the positioning of photographs and typography and color that created this wonderful kind of sense, this kind of weird juxtaposition, which I'd never seen before, which called the Swiss grid style, and so I would go every week in the break and I'd read that book, which I didn't understand, but I couldn't take it out because it's a reference library. But that became my little Bible. And that guy that I asked about getting a job, he came to me in the summer period and said, oh, they need someone at our place as a kind of general messenger and dog's body, really. And that's where I went. I left the shirt factory boy house, which I hated, and I was suddenly in a world where there were airbrush artists, retouchers, typographers, typesetters, photographers, all in one building servicing the advertising industry. So that became my kind of, if you like, foundation, equivalent of foundation school. So I traveled through each department, very small departments, but realizing that there was this whole world that I never knew existed. You know, my world was seeing my dad coming home from Ford's absolutely dirty and having what he would call a washdown in the scullery, which is the kitchen, with one foot in the sink in a bowl while my mother was trying to cook behind him. Totally ridiculous. And, you know, I wanted to leave that world. And I suddenly realized that this creative world that I'd entered, albeit on a very lowly level, was the beginning of the ladder. And from then on, there was no stopping me. I used every job as a training place, and I moved on pretty quickly.
So that must have been a magical moment to kind of see this world opening up in front of you.
I felt I was not supposed to be where I was, because everybody, traditional working class with low horizon, all they liked was sport, as my father did. His escape from his daily grind was sport to such an extent that as a kid I was dragged along to rugby and football matches and I couldn't see anything because I was so small. And it was to get me out of the house, because there were three of us, all boys. We did actually have a sister, but she sadly died. And the age levels were not close enough to be all buddy. You know, my older brother was going to be called up in the army. My younger brother was very young, and there was me. So I felt really out of place. And anyway, moving into this world, I suddenly thought, this is my escape ticket. And it was, because I went on from strength to strength. And one day, walking past this little, really a little, what looked like a shopfront in Farringdon Road, not far from where my studio is now, actually. And there was a shop window, and in the middle of the window was this wonderful illustration. So I'd walk past this place every week, and there'd be a new illustration in the window. And I went inside on one particular day, and I asked this chap, very tall, elegant-looking chap, who said yes. I said, I wondered why you have these images in the window. And he said, well, we're an artist agent. We represent illustrators. And I thought, wow, I didn't know that sort of thing existed. He said, why? Why do you ask? And I said, well, the illustrations are fantastic. And, you know, I was just curious. And he said, well, what do you do? And I said, oh, well, I work for a little commercial art studio. And I assist one of the designers there. And he said, well, do you have any work? And I said, oh, well, I only have work that I do in the evenings myself. And he said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I go to the local bookshops and I look at covers that I don't think are very good. And then I redesign them in the evenings at home. And he said, well, bring some in to me. I'll be interested. And so 2 days later, I went back to this guy with my little A4 plastic folder. And he looked through, and I'm sitting there nervously, and he said, well, these are rather good. And I said, oh, thanks. And he said, how would you like to come and work here? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we need someone that can put typography onto these illustrations, which are mostly for book covers, and the publishers, they don't have people to do it. They have to get freelance people. And we want to set up a little situation here where we can provide that service to the publishers that we provide illustrations to. Anyway, that, long story short, I became the in-house designer in this little place, and I met so many fantastic people, absolutely brilliant illustrators from around the world who were who were providing illustrations for magazine advertising and so forth. And one guy was American, a guy called Bruce McDonald, who looked fantastic, straight out of Mad Men. He had the most amazing Ivy League suit, which I completely zeroed in on. And he said to me one day, I've got a couple of friends who've come over from Cincinnati and they've started a design consultancy. And I'd never heard that before, the word consultancy. And they're looking for designers. Would you like to go and have an interview? And I did. And I was in the sort of the bottom end of Fleet Street in this company I was working for. And suddenly they were in Albemarle Street in Mayfair next to the Marlborough Gallery. Anyway, I went to this interview and I got the job. And that was, for me, was fantastic because I suddenly saw design on a totally different level. They had a guy working there who was an expert in marketing and they used great photographers. And so I spent, I think, about 3 years with them. And in between that, I was doing freelance book covers from a range of publishers myself by this time. You know, I've been blessed with luck. I was taking a design into William Heinemann, the publishers, to the art director there, or art editor, as he was called. And he said, I just want to let you know I'm leaving. And I said, oh, no. Because he was giving me, by then, some very nice work. He was an ex-Royal College guy. And he said to me, well, why don't you apply for the job? And I said, what do I do? And he said, it's advertised in the bookseller, which is, I think they call it the organ of the publishing industry. And if I went straight to W.H. Smith and they said, oh, no, you can't buy that. It's a subscription magazine. You'll find it in libraries. So I went to the nearest library and sure enough, they had it, the latest copy. So I applied for the job. I went along for the interview and I figured that the people interviewing me would not really know that much technically about design because there was only one art editor there. It was just him. And so they said, well, do you know about printing, Michael? And I said, oh, yes, I know all about printing. I knew nothing about letterpress printing. I knew nothing about litho printing. They gave me the job. And the first thing I did was to phone up the printers that they used and said, look, I know nothing about printing. And they said, don't worry, because they were getting quite a lot of work. We'll tell you everything. And they did. And I bless them for that. And that was the beginning of 10 years in publishing. I went from Heinemann to Collins and loved every minute. And that took me right up to starting what was then Carolyn Dempsey with another designer who worked exclusively in publishing. We started off in 1979 in an economic downturn.
Just at the moment that Thatcher was arriving.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, it was the winter of discontent. That was all coming up. That was all.
So before we move on to that, I'm interested in this publishing sort of phase. Clearly the book jacket and whether it was also you talk in other things I've read around designing for the music industry and for album covers, and they similarly they have a similar thing. The connection between typography and illustration or image making, whether it's photography or illustrative work, clearly is a very foundational part of how you've ended up your practice and your work and your style. But it's not a unique training, but starting into that publishing world and then going into consultancy later, clearly that had a big and a profound influence on your process and on your practice and the relationship to how you commission illustrators or how you do that illustration work yourself, which you've done. Can you talk a bit more about that?
One of the things about publishing, which is interesting, particularly in those days, I mean, it's changed a lot, is that they never had any money. So designers would love the freedom that they got designing book covers, but they didn't get a lot of money. That was the kind of deal. It was, you could engage good designers. And because the previous art director at Heinemann was from the Royal College himself, he had been using Royal College designers. So suddenly I was on a different level. I was on a really high level of design work. So I was able to use that, if you like, my version of going to art school, to college, because I was seeing great work and I was learning. And the other thing is you have to be very resourceful with book covers. So you have to learn to do everything yourself. So I studied photography. I started to illustrate a lot. I could draw anyway. And so I would do the whole package. And that's what many designers do. And because I was, in essence, commissioning many of these designers, I had a really good, strong community of photographers, illustrators, and graphic designers. And that put me in good stead later, you know, when I started a company. So the publishing area where I suppose I became noticed, DNAD was in its infancy back in the in that period, and I started to enter my work and slowly got recognized as an art director and designer of book covers. So I established myself as a designer in that world, and so I'm very grateful to it because I loved it. I love publishing, and I still do. I love the world. It's just been taken over mostly by American conglomerates and taken all those wonderful independent publishers that were all over London in the 1960s and put them under one roof. And they have big marketing departments, and they can employ anyone they like in terms of design. They put in an art director, and you end up with covers looking, as they do mostly if you go to Waterstones, with huge type, no matter what the illustration is underneath that someone sweated over, or a photographer. They're all geared towards what it looks like on Amazon, at Matchbox size. So I feel sorry for the designers, because there are a lot of brilliant designers who have to compromise their work. And I just think that's shocking. Okay, they get much more money than I did back then, but there's a quid pro quo.
And I suppose the back, you know, when you were active in that space, it's a lovely demand of having to get across a message and a feeling about a book very, very quickly. And I suppose that's the essence of visual communication, isn't it? Is how do you communicate with the in 3 or 4 seconds, whether it's a billboard on the, you know, when you're going along on the bus, or whether it's something that you see in the back on the back of a newspaper or magazine or a book cover, the distillation of an idea into words and images is the essence of in a way that practice, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And if you can use conceptual thinkings in such a way that maybe it has wit or whatever that can get people engaged with it, make it intriguing, that's terrific, because you've got your audience to actually be part of the, you know, revealing the thing. But these days, with book covers particularly, you have that aspect to it, but then it's totally abused by overly giving information. So, you know, books were very straightforward. They used to be, you would have a cover one side, a pretty good design, and then you turn it over and on the back you'd have all the quotes. These days it's the other way around. They put everything on the front and usually advertise other books on the back. And it really is a marketing tool in the worst possible circumstances these days. I mean, you still get some great talented people that will break through the net. In America particularly, graphic designers in publishing are treated far better than they are here. And so if you look at American book covers by the really good designers there, they quite often are astonishingly good. I mean, really good. They blow everything out of the water. Generally speaking, probably 80 to 90% is just mediocre to rubbish.
So just to go back to the 70s,
yeah.
What was the trigger for starting your Carroll and Dempsey and the idea of consulting, or what was that well, transition from publishing into consultancy?
Well, really, a little bit of what I've just said. What happened was, towards the late 70s, the time I was at Fontana, which is part of Collins, suddenly we had a new sales director from Australia who said to me one morning, Mike, have you seen this? And it was an American book cover with gold foil blocking on it, right? And I'd seen this loads of times, you know. And I thought, oh no, gold foil blocking. I knew what was coming. And at this time, some of the large American firms were beginning to sniff around for buying up publishers. So I thought the writing's on the wall for me. I'd been friends a lot with the designer Ken Carroll, and we talked a bit about we'd had enough of publishing, and we thought that because our work had got into DNAD quite a bit by then, that we wouldn't have much trouble getting into, you know, starting our own thing. And also I wanted to move into other areas like television and film, because I figured that if you try to find clients in areas that you personally love, it would be a much greater relationship, because you really love the area that they work in and want to give it their all. So that was my ambition, to find clients. We decided that we'd do that. One afternoon at Collins, we sat down together and said, okay, let's do it. So I resigned. The publishers were kind of shocked, and they said to me, look, would you carry on doing the covers, you know, until we can find someone? I said, sure, we'll do them as freelance. So that was a client. Ken Carroll had clients too, and we then had set about finding somewhere. And believe it or not, we ended up in Bond Street on the top floor of a building that no one seemed to want. And we decorated it ourselves. And when we got there, it had several filing cabinets and loads of stuff left behind. And I started to look at this, and then I realized why nobody wanted to take it, because it turned out to be an abortion referral office. And so these files and these voice recordings on the tape recorder were all from, you know, young girls, Italy and Ireland, you know, wanting an abortion. So it was really awful to discover that. So all that stuff went into the rubbish, along with all those terrible stories. And we decorated it, and that was it. We started, and we managed. And I had no idea that there was an economic downturn. I wasn't that interested, or I understood politics that much. But somehow we sailed through, and we did exactly what I said to you just now. We went to London Weekend Television and immediately picked up work and so on. And it just flowed like that. Within a year, we had two assistants. I think we stayed at this place for about 3 years. And we then moved to Regent Street. And we were on the top floor of where the Apple building now is. Again, we sort of kitted it out. We by then had, I think, about six assistants. And we had more and more work. I then began to get into film title sequences because I wanted to get into film, and that all worked. And then Crown Estates, who owned the building, came to us and said, we want to develop this building and we'll pay you to get out. And that was negotiated. And we found an old warehouse in Bloomsbury. And it was at a time in the 80s, it was about 1985, when, again, another economic downturn. And all of the architects had no work at all. So we got in about three architects, among them David Chipperfield, who was really only doing interiors, really. He hadn't done a building then. And we got David Chipperfield to do the building. It was fantastic. I mean, we had this wonderful building, and then we went from strength to strength. I've been so lucky, and it was almost like a mad dream. It was just on an upwards trajectory.
The other thing I wanted to chat about which may be bit later as well, but music, you know, music clearly is a very big part of your sort of life force, and you designed, you were connected into the music industry via your practice, weren't you?
Yes.
With various working on the graphic side of the albums. But yes. Tell me about why and how music has affected what you do.
Well, my brother is a musician, and from a very early age, I mean, obviously like most kids, we had a Dansett record player. I would go to Petticoat Lane on a Sunday morning where you could get ex-jukebox records. You just have to buy one of those little things to put in the mm-hmm. centre. So I would buy, you know, Little Richard and Buddy Holly and all of those groups. And so I love music. I love the radio for another reason, but I love listening. Looking and listening were my thing. Reading, I had trouble with until quite late on in my life because of my dyslexic problem. So looking and listening are key factors with me. My brother would be practicing all the time in the house, and he was a modern jazz freak. So I got a wider vocabulary of music than maybe kids would normally. So, you know, Miles Davis and the whole raft of modern jazz players was going through my ears. And although it wasn't me, I eventually learned to love it. And he used to play with a big band at the Marquee Club in London on Sunday nights. And I would go with him in his van, and I would sit in the Marquee and just watch the band. It was great. And so I've always loved music. And then I got onto classical music because my brother also had a wide vocabulary of classical music. And so that was a whole new world for me there. So just like, you know, we were talking at the beginning about the breadth of design and all of the disciplines, it's exactly the same in music. So I've always been interested in new wave music, electronic music and so forth, because it's the same territory. It's lots of creative people involved in different aspects of that world. So when I had by then Carol Dempsey and Thirkell that became CDT, I designed credits for a David Hare film, and I went along to the recording of the music for his film. Well, I met these two twins. They ran an orchestra for film music. It was Christopher and Nigel Warren Green. They were very chatty, and they said they bought the rights to an orchestra that had been defunct since the 1950s called the London Chamber Orchestra. And they said, so would you help us? We want to try and break the barriers between classical music and young people. And so I did. And I got a great fashion photographer. We got them styled and to wear totally different clothing. They were all young, and they did a few concerts, and it was absolutely terrific. They then got a contract with Virgin Records for a 10-album deal, and I got to do all the covers, and it was just... It was like manna from heaven. It was one of the greatest jobs I've ever done. And I stayed with that orchestra for, oh, I don't know, 2 decades, 3 decades, on and off. And sadly, the very thing that they wanted to do was to break out of that stranglehold of white, middle-class, grey-haired people sitting in an auditorium, you know, Sir John Smith Square or wherever, South Bank. And it happened a bit at the beginning. And as with so many of these young orchestras that want to break through, the last time I saw them several years ago, they were just another orchestra in penguin suits playing the usual Mozart and Beethoven and not doing very much, no minimalist stuff anymore. It shows you what a stranglehold that world has to exist in.
A bit like the book industry, isn't it? It's the same. It suffers maybe from the same thing of needing to be popular or needing to be mass or needing to comply with certain cultures or traditions.
I think actually sort of now, because of ambient music, I use Spotify a lot, and I don't know if you do, but Spotify they lock in. They've got an algorithm which is fantastic. It locks into what you appear to like and offer you and give you suggestions every day. And some of them are astonishing. I mean, really, they get every single ambient composer you can imagine from all around the world and presented to you on a daily basis, saying you might like this. And more often than not, I do. So I think that music is delivered now in a much more interesting way. And I hope that orchestras can actually exist with a much wider audience. You know, young people that really can appreciate what's going on now. That is changing. I really do now. I think music's changed so much in all areas that it will be much more interesting.
And I think, I mean, we have lost a few things, haven't we? Because in a way, the album is not as an idea. You know, you don't listen to it. Six or eight tracks. No. You browse and you skip and you shuffle and you move.
Absolutely. That's right. The idea of a concept album that really developed from just standard album, they really don't exist. I mean, there are one or two. And of course, vinyl is back in a big way, but that's just a kind of... It's a bit like people using roll film again. It's a nostalgia that the people that are buying it mostly never lived through. Okay, there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of collectors that say, oh, it's better on vinyl. But it's a bit like seeing, as you do sometimes, young 20-somethings reading a book with an old Penguin cover from the 1960s. It has that very stripped-back, clinical look because it's something they relate to. They think this is better than having one of those covers covered in quotes. So I think it's trying to express your own particular view on the world by either dressing in a particular way, carrying things with you. It's all part of the theatre of being a person, which as you get older doesn't seem to matter so much.
No, and I think actually before we move on, I think the one thing I learnt recently was in Spotify, an artist will get a royalty check or whatever it is, pennies or pence, or after 31 seconds of it being played. And as a result, people are now putting the chorus. You can't have a slow lead in to a track.
Oh, God.
You get the chorus in the first because you have to persuade people not to skip until they've got to 31 seconds, which is such a sad reality. But in a way, maybe it's also stimulating a different creative response and a different reality. And that was going to lead me on to a question around this transition from analog to digital, from print to the moving image. And in a way, Martin Nambi-Len is a sort of, you know, as a sort of trailblazer of TV, of TV graphics, and moving away from a static two-dimensional image to a dynamic three-dimensional image. And that, even though we've lost some of the craft, in a way, of print, we've also emerged into a new wonderful craft of the digital world and the moving image. And I'm wondering what you feel about that.
I totally embrace the digital world. I mean, there's nothing worse than spending, you know, your life pasting things up onto a board. I mean, it's so antiquated that period, you know, that once I realised that digital was going to help us. I think that the thing about the introduction of digital, if you look back, certainly at graphic design when it was first introduced, you were confronted by software that gave you grid lines and all sorts of devices to help you line things up. And a lot of designers found the grid lines, which you were not supposed to use, they were there as guides, as pieces of design in their own right. So if you go back to the early period of digital, you'll see graphics with all those lines exposed because they thought, wow, this looks great. And it's a nonsense, really. It's just a style and was getting in the way, a sort of decorative aspect. But you know, I wholeheartedly embrace digital. I'm not very good at learning from instruction books. So I do it by rote. I just do it over and over again, make mistakes and do it. So I'm okay. I've been working now on the computer for donkey's years, and I love what it can do. And of course, in every single aspect. So for example, traditional film editing suddenly disappeared, and editing was done digitally. And all those editors that for so many years had, you know, were cutting bits of negative and putting in directions for transitions could do it on the spot as you were there. What that has done is it means that more people can get involved and interfere. That's a downside with digital. Everyone now knows that you can do things a lot faster and make changes very quickly, to such an extent you can have someone sitting breathing down your neck while those changes are being made, saying, well, can't we have that other color? So there's a downside to it. The world of the designer used to be an area where they'd literally got their arms around their work. You know, it was a kind of secret world, but now it's open for anyone to look at and comment on. But that's life, isn't it? But I think the upside is that you can do the most astonishing things, as we know. There's really very little you can't do. You know, they now are really considering bringing back movie stars because they've captured every movement, every facial expression, their voice, that they can reconstruct them. And you can have a film with Marilyn Monroe in it. And that no doubt will happen.
I think it brings me back to this idea of what's a good client. Because certainly in our practice at Pearson Lloyd, we really need a brief. And we very rarely work outside a brief because we like the tension and the boundaries and the challenge of needing to solve a problem or to deliver a piece of whatever of design. And I think in any when you've got a palette or a canvas, I think the relationship between the brief and the client is clearly something that elicits the quality, doesn't it?
Yes, we both inhabit a world that demands a client. We're not fine artists. We would be the client if we were fine artists. And certainly, I'm not saying that we can't do that. I mean, I paint outside of what I do because I've always loved that. But solving a problem for a client, either collaboratively or yourself, is what it's all about. And that's the challenge, isn't it? You know, the moment you get that job, whatever it might be, it's in your head 24/7. You wake up in the middle of the night, maybe. I always have a notebook by my bed anyway. I've always done that because I do wake up sometimes and think, oh, damn, that would be good. I think that's what they come to us for, because they want someone to look at this problem and solve it and bring something new or create something that hasn't been done before.
And also that sense that you, where you can distill a message down to something that is so layered, whether it's a physical object or a graphic idea. And you know, that's such a, when you see it and you understand it, it's such a joy, isn't it, to, you know, that realization.
You're absolutely right. That's what really good design is. It's taking the complexity and reducing it to something that is, in essence, so simple that you think, why didn't I think of that? Mm. It's so much better. It's removing things rather than adding things.
And I suppose Alan Fletcher was a great example, wasn't he, of, you know, who you were working in that period in the 80s and 90s, sort of as someone who could distill, as you said earlier, with humour, some messaging into such sort of joy.
Well, the great thing about Alan is I remember I interviewed him for Design Week when he'd left Pentagram. You know, he'd left several years. And I went over to his studio and we sat and chatted, and I realized then that what he'd done, he said to me in his, you know, gruff voice, he said he'd fed up with clients, you know, and meetings. He didn't want to go to another meeting. And looking at his work, he'd actually got to a point where he'd reduced everything to such simplicity. So mostly he used his handwriting, scratchy handwriting. He mostly used either colored paper, torn, cut with scissors, really, really simple ideas, which were terrific. And very much him, very much coming from Alan and not in any way being tainted with the things that he had discarded, you know, like, you know, masses of typography. It was him just expressing himself in a very witty way and being playful, which is what he did right up until he sadly died.
Yes, and we've talked about that a lot, haven't we, in the Faculty of Royal Designers, this relationship of joy and beauty and how powerful they are, as well as us needing to add value in other ways. The value of joy and the value of beauty are still very something that we need to cherish.
I agree. You know, sometimes when we hear the term of benefit to society, it sounds very grand. But for me, just viewing something that is beautiful is of benefit to society. It doesn't have to be the most amazing piece of work to help someone walk or whatever, and indeed that's very important. But simple beauty and the craft of putting something together is also so pleasing that people should be applauded for that too.
And I kind of, something else on my mind is what you mentioned about dyslexia, you know, your struggle with writing and as a kid. And we've discussed this before, I think, I've got this suspicion that, you know, the Faculty of Royal Designers is not, I wouldn't say full of dyslexic, but is there are many, that transition from one part of your brain to another and the ability to communicate through either the drawn hand or the physical object, I think is, and actually what we're doing is you see the world through different eyes. And I think that creativity and the sort of neurodiversity of dyslexia, if you like, there's a very powerful connection between those two things. And I think it's something to be absolutely cherished.
You're quite right. I mean, certainly in many of the interviews I've done, that I found a lot of people that have the same problems. So I think in my experience, many designers I've met really are on spectrum, and they're far happier our world and work happily in it. I joined the local library when I was a kid for two reasons. One, I liked the feel of the place and the smell, and two, it was warm in the winter. And I'd go there, and I'd mostly go in the reference library there, just as I did when I went to the evening school, because I could look at things. So, for example, they'd have the National Geographic magazine, and I would look through that, not necessarily for all the wonderful photographs about the sort of hidden tribes and so forth, but I'd look at the ads, and I'd look at the American cars and the fact that Americans seemed to have coloured television in the 1950s. So I developed my ways of seeing things. And I'll tell you just one little story, because it relates to my future then path. And that was, I became obsessed, probably around about a 14-year-old, with book covers. I would look at all the book covers. And one day, there was one book cover that I hadn't seen before. It's brand new. They used to put them in a separate rack. And what they would do is they would cover the book jackets in a film, and they put numbers on the spines to protect them. And I saw this book cover, and I thought, wow, I've never seen anything quite like this. And it was a book called Quartet by de Sade. And it was a very simple graphic cover, and I wanted it. So I got the book out, I carefully removed the cover and put the number back on the spine, because a lot of them didn't have covers, and so they didn't notice. And although I stole it, I consider it now as liberating it, and also even more that, protecting. I've still got that cover in immaculate condition, and that cover was done by a man called Keith Cunningham, who went to the Royal College. He was a painter, and he also taught graphics at the London College of Printing, as it was then. And many, many, many years in my life, when I was interviewing for Design Magazine, I found him and interviewed him. And that's a different story, which I won't tell now, but it turned into the most amazing story, which I've written about. And for him, sadly, he's dead, the most amazing experience as well.
Well, I think we should cherish the idea that design sees the world differently, and that we have the, not power, but we just have a different, our senses are tuned maybe in a different way. And people who are drawn to design are maybe drawn to design because the facilities that they have, or the limitations they have in other ways, allow them to thrive in that space. And I think, coming back to the faculty, it's a wonderful representation of this broad church of creativity that we, you know, seek to celebrate, and also need to advocate for society and for government, so that it doesn't get lost in the kind of the drive for growth and the drive for wealth and all those things that that politicians so often discuss?
Well, sadly, you know, the government are cutting back on the very areas that you just talked about. Design, music, theatre, all of those things, for me, are really important. And, you know, when we have a government, as we do at the moment, that just seems to be in total chaos, I'm very fearful. My daughter-in-law is a teacher at a very tough school in East London, and she's head of art. And they have to literally beg with parents to, you know, give them some money to get books and things. I mean, that is just shocking. And it's sad as well to think that in this day and age, in this country, in the creative industries have been so instrumental in bringing in lots of money into this country that we're treated so badly. It really is, it's obscene. And those things need to be talked about.
Well, look, Mike, I think we're probably drawing to a close because we could talk forever, but we're a good hour into our chat.
Okay.
And I don't know whether we haven't even really got through into your CDT moment and after that, but clearly you continue to be fully activated in the world of the design industry. And, you know, I suppose your motivations continue regardless of where your clients are coming from.
I have to say, you know, on the client side, the pandemic really changed everything because, you know, I was working on a very large project, which I was finding personally so complex, but I was doing it and everything was fine. And then suddenly halfway through the job, I got a call saying, you know, because of the pandemic, we're going to have to, curtail. And basically I was delighted. And I realized I don't want to be standing up in front of 20 lawyers presenting. Yeah. I don't want that. So yeah. I love what I do. I write more. I enjoy doing this. I'm very honored to be part of the RDI, and I've always tried to be involved with it as much as possible and do whatever I can. And I do that for some charities and things, and I'm always doing something. I think once a designer, you'll be a designer until you're deleted, basically.
And I think, you know, to finish off, the what started maybe just as an instinct, I think RDI Insights as a set of now, you know, more than 50 recording, that's an extraordinary sort of gift in a way to our industry and to, as we've said, as a sound archive, these conversations are a very powerful recollection and memory, a collective memory, if you like, of the design sector. So I think that should be cherished and will be. To finish off, what advice would you give to a young designer following in your footsteps?
Advice, always a tricky one. Well, during the many interviews I made with rural designers, they all gave plenty of advice. So I can only give you what has helped me throughout my career and before. So first, it's a state of mind. I think you need passion and self-belief. And for a designer, everything is a creative opportunity. Also, get into the habit of problem solving. At the beginning of this interview, when I was working as a messenger / dog's body in a commercial art studio, I would often spend my lunch hour in the bookshop where I would pick up a book cover that I felt was badly or boringly designed. And at home in the evenings, I'd come up with my own solution. And at the time, that became my problem solving exercise. You kind of have to act rather like a musician and practice until inhibition fades and your thinking flows. Well, next I'd say don't just hang out with people in your own design discipline. Get to know and absorb all of the creative world, film, theatre, photography, music, literature, art, opera and acting. And fill your head with all this stuff as it will enrich your thinking. When looking for a first job or wanting to move on to another, always look at the quality of the work the company produces and do your homework, certainly about the key people producing that work. It will create a far more engaging interview. And I'd say avoid working for a company lacking a moral compass, because design is a powerful business and it's capable of doing harm. Stay curious. You never know where it might lead you. And being part of the creative world is a wonderful profession. I've loved every minute of it, and you can too.
Well, maybe that's a great place to end, Mike. It's been a total pleasure.
Thank you very much, Tom.